Now, here's the thing. Judging from my mailbox, many believing Christians are very aware of the criminal history of the church. But they excuse themselves from all complicity. The perpetrators of individual cruelties, mass abuse and wars of genocide and conquest were, it seemed, not real Christians at all. Real Christians could do none of these things because Christ, we're told, taught a message of peace and love and humility, even poverty. If only the church had followed the message of Jesus, none of those centuries filled with bloodshed and suffering would have unfolded the way they did. So by a quick sidestep, today's Christians wash their hands of any and all crimes, misdeeds and follies of their forebears. But let's take a closer look at this, because it is mighty strange that for more than 15 centuries and across all the world's continents, self-styled Christians have willfully or unwittingly misunderstood the message of their Lord and robbed when they should have given, punished when they should have helped, and murdered when they should have loved. So why have Christians always got the message wrong? Could it be that the message is rather less straightforward than many of today's more humane Christians naively imagine? Christians, that is, civilized by science and secularism. But let's consider Jesus himself. Jesus preached an absolutist belief of good and evil, with no shades of grey. Whoever is not with me is against me, he says. Those who believe will not be damned, but unbelief arouses his anger, his impatience, and his utter abuse. In Luke 19:27, Jesus calls for the murder in front of him of all those who refuse to worship him. Jesus pours forth a stream of invective. He threatens insatiable revenge, outer darkness and an eternal punishment, explicitly stated at least 30 times. You love your neighbor as yourself, but only if he receives the good news. If not, shake off the dust from your feet, and it'll be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. Depart, says Jesus, into everlasting fire. Jesus calls his detractors serpents and a generation of vipers. He promises them a fire that is never quenched. In fact, his attitude is an assurance of everlasting torture. The Gospels are an immoral fraud, and Jesus is not Mr. Nice Guy at all, but an intolerant, vindictive, egotistical bully, just like the priests who invented him.
Oh no! What evil lurks in the hearts of men?
Terrible Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581.
Yep, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Little horse today. How about that? It is the July, and it's the 29th. Hey, we're almost into August. We're already getting some of our donations in for the sub. That's good. Thank you. And this is Wotan, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Well, I just got back from the YMCA. We got a big one, a brand new one here in town. Yeah. And I'm doing my workouts in the pool. And I was walking in the water up to my chest. Seemed to be doing a pretty good job. But today I tried a new thing, which is probably not new to any of you. But I ran in the water, when the water up to my chest, you run or let or get into a little not quite so deep and run at least water up to your waist. And you know, boy, that really gets you going. You can run. You don't run very fast. But I think that's a hell of an exercise, so I'm going to keep at that for a while and see if I can become Tarzan like I used to be. Yeah! Well, let's go back to The Pessimist's Guide to History. And we're going to bring it up to 6 million years ago. The Mediterranean Sea dries up. The Mediterranean's connection with the Atlantic Ocean, what is known today as the Strait of Gibraltar, was closed off for about 6 million years ago by the drifting together of North Africa and Europe. The Mediterranean waters rapidly evaporated, leaving nothing but salty pools of water until, on a number of occasions, the continents parted briefly, allowing Atlantic waters to again flow into the Mediterranean. The Strait of Gibraltar has remained open continuously for the last 5 million years. That's quite a long time. What the hell, I'll give you two of them today. How about that? 1,000 years ago, you know, when you complain about what's going on today, listen to some of this stuff. 1,000 years ago, the last ice age, the change probably began with the barely perceptible cooling of the climate that lasted for thousands of years. And then some 85,000 years ago, temperatures finally dropped so low that a great ice age began. Slowly, the thick sheets of ice covering North Polar region advanced southward. As the cold worsened, some 18 million cubic miles of water froze, and the sea levels dropped from 425 feet, dropped by 425 feet. Wow! North America, Europe, and northern Siberia were largely buried under nearly 2 miles of ice, and Asia and North America were joined by a massive bridge of ice. In the southern hemisphere, the South Polar ice cap spread northward to cover New Zealand and the Andes Mountains. By the time the ice age reached its peak about 18,000 years ago, ice in the northern hemisphere extended as far south as southern Illinois, and that would be southern Indiana, too. In New Hampshire, the 6,300-foot Mount Washington was buried in ice up to its peak. Some areas not covered by ice became vast deserts. Regions of Africa that are now rainforests were covered by sand and dunes. By about 10,000 years ago, the ice had largely receded from western North America, and by 7,000 years ago, the ice age was over.
Come on, Ma, we can get in a sleigh and take a ride, man.
The drastic climate changes during the long ice age devastated the world's animal species. Competition for reduced food supplies and other factors drove half of the species in Europe and North America into extinction within 20,000 years. I notice they're always talking about things going extinct now. Well, that's nothing compared to how many went extinct back then. Most of the world's large land mammals died out, including the saber-toothed cat, a 12-foot-tall kangaroo. How'd you like to meet one of those? A 3-ton ground sloth and a 14-foot tusk mammoth. Only in parts of Africa did the large mammals survive. As zoologist Alfred Wallace put it, we live in a zoologically impoverished world from which all the hugest and fiercest and strangest forms have recently disappeared. While it is certainly the latest, this ice age was by no means the only one experienced over the millennia. In fact, there have been 4 separate ice ages in the last 2 million years, the other 3 lasting from approximately 1.6 to 1.3 million years ago, 900,000 to 700,000 years ago, and 550,000 to 400,000 years ago, respectively. One could only wonder if this latest ice age is really the last. You know what I did? I knew I recognized that. I read that to you before, and I didn't mark this right. And what the hell? I got to get more careful on marking these things. Well, I'll give you one more then. 10,000 years ago, making of the Sahara Desert. At one time, the area was now known as the Sahara Desert was green and fertile. Tree-covered mountains towered over rivers and lakes, while wildlife, including hippos, rhinoceroses, elephants, and other animals, thrived in the area. Tribes of niggers, primitive people, flourished too, raising crops and tending herds of animals. I don't think those were necessarily Negroes. They might have been hybrids, because the Negroes primarily just took the fruit off the trees and stuff like that and hunted wild animals. I think. I wasn't there at that time. I know you think I was. What happened to transform this bountiful region of Africa to a barren desert it is today? Mother Nature loves to play tricks on us, just like she's going to do again and again and again. Shifts in climate and geology over a period of hundreds of millions of years had already changed the area's environment many times. There were periods when ice-covered parts of the continental drift gradually positioned North Africa at the equator, where high atmosphere pressure prevented the formation of clouds and rain. 10,000 years ago, the rivers and lakes gradually began to dry up. As lack of water killed off plant life, winds eroded the land, eventually leaving only fine, dry sand that could neither sustain crops nor hold moisture. This is one example of what drastic atmospheric changes can do. Is the greenhouse effect an acceleration of such change? Well, this book was written, ways back, 1992, and they were already talking about the greenhouse effect. So that's it for that particular reading today. And we'll get back in sync here pretty quick. And I don't mean Cinco de Mayo. I've got a lot of files on genealogy and history by my mother that I haven't even begun to attack. Let me read you this little historical note. The title to all the lands in Indiana was obtained by the United States for the United States by cession from the state of Virginia by act of the General Assembly of the Commonwealth of Virginia on December 20th, 1783. So this land out here in Indiana was part of Virginia at one time. Agreeably to the above recited act, the whole territory northwest of the Ohio River was on March 1, 1784, transferred to the United States by deed signed by Thomas Jefferson, Samuel Hardy, Arthur Lee, James Monroe, then delegates in Congress from said Commonwealth. Upon the extinction of the Indian title or right of occupancy by treaties with the various tribes of Indians, we want the goddamn land and we're going to take it. We just made the treaty null and void. Might makes right, boys and girls. These lands were surveyed and sold to the settlers, and the developers made a lot of money. We wouldn't say that about our founding fathers. They're such a wonderful bunch of con men. People worship these founding fathers, tickle me. I mean, they were men. They put their pants on one leg at a time, just like you do if you're a man, and maybe if you're a woman. But the way they worship the founders, the founding fathers. Now, of course, most of the people that talk that stuff, especially politicians, don't give a shit about the founding fathers, or we'd still have a country that was all white, according to the original Constitution. The treaty at Tippecanoe, October 26th and 7th, 1832, treaty at Carrie Mission, September 20th, 1828, and the treaty of Missinwaptober, 23rd, 1826, in addition to these, was the treaty at Missanawa, October 23, 1826, concerning the Michigan Road. The first named treaty embraced all the land in the county, except a small part in the northeast corner, which is covered by the second named treaty, and the land south of the Tippecanoe River, which is covered by the third named treaty. That's the area where I'm living, the region I'm living in. The government surveys were made in December 1833 and January 1834. Michigan road land sections were surveyed in 1832, as appears by the field notes on file in the recorder's office of Marshall County, Indiana. Marshall County, I'm pretty sure, is the next county over to the west. For various purposes, the United States ceded large tracts of land to the state of Indiana, and they are known as the Canal Lands, C-A-N-A-L, Michigan Road Lands, Swamp Lands, Saline Lands, University Lands, Seminary Lands, and School Lands. The state sold these under various acts of the General Assembly, and patents were issued to the purchasers in the name of the state. All these patents are recorded in the office of the auditor of the state of Indiana, except those for school lands, which are recorded in the records of the boards of commissioners of the counties in which the land is situated. Down at the bottom, there's a footnote. The lands known as swamp lands were granted to the state of Indiana by the Act of Congress approved September 28, 1850. Entitled, An Act to Enable State of Arkansas and Other States to Reclaim the Swamp Lands Within Their Limits, see U.S. Statutes at Large. The title to this land vested in the state of Indiana by virtue of said Act of Congress without the issuing of a patent, therefore, by the U.S. So, I mean, that's just one little sheet of paper I pulled out of the file. And I'm going to start going into it more and more. Because you see, this is all quite complicated, all this development and states arising and being split off and all this. And it was all about economy and money and developers and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, when did you hear about that in school, how that happened, how it went on? I don't remember ever being told about it. I never knew that Indiana Territory, and maybe Illinois, and certainly at least part of Ohio, was attached to Virginia. Well, that makes me a Southerner, a goddamn rebel. Where's my flag? Give my flag, Ma. Yeah, so anyhow, once in a while I'll dig something like that and read to you, and you'll say, is that guy going goddamn nuts? Is he going to read that shit to us all day long? Well, I think it's important. Now we're going to get back into Jack Nelson's book on the terror down in Rebel Town. Down south. But I've got something that somebody sent me a note, and a lot of times if they send me a note that's interesting, I'll stick it in a book I think it's going to apply to. Well, someone sent me a short explanation of some of the things that were going on down there in Jackson. I'm going to read it to you. Here are some facts in reply to the People Magazine story on the story behind the Hollywood propaganda called Mississippi Burning. Alton Wayne Roberts made a deal with the FBI Special Agent Proctor and others that he and his brother, who was not arrested, be given $30,000 in return for setting up Leroy Terrence and Kathy Ainsworth. Terrence was a member of the Mississippi White Knights, and the FBI and the ADL both wanted him and Sam Bowers taken out of action at any cost. In an ambush, these murdering dogs shot and killed white activists and local schoolteacher Kathy Ainsworth, who was with Leroy Terrence. The assassination attempt failed, and Leroy, although severely wounded, survived. There was evidence that over 100 shots had been fired at the couple, including machine guns. The head kike of the operation was A.I. Botnick, who was at that time regional director of the New Orleans ADL. The blood money was given to a local Jew boy by the name of Meyer Davidson, and I read about him to you from that book on where the Jews are down here in Mississippi. Well, he was a rich guy there in Jackson. Or maybe he was in Laurel, but one of the two. And he was the one that he was scared shitless. Davison, who lived in Neshoba County, gave the money to government killer and agent Proctor to turn over to the Roberts brothers. It was the direct treason of these bastards that enabled the government to find out the dead vermin and start the persecution of the white people in its first place. Then Mayor Clayton Lewis was acting as informer for Agent Proctor and may have played a part in the death of Matt Murphy, head lawyer for the legal defense team. So there's a little bit of information that you probably won't get anyplace else. It might be around, but it'd be really hard to find. I'm going to put that, take that note and take it out of my Jack Nelson book and put it in with the book on where the Jews were all at, all over the United States. And I'll put it in the chapter about Jackson and Laurel, Mississippi. That's the way I do things. I underline things and then I put things, notes in books. And later I can go back and look at them and retrace my steps. Because, you know, from time... Every decade, I forget everything. Then I got to start all over again. I don't have many left. Well, I've got my bookcase almost redone to where it's in the middle of my bunker, and it's going 6 or 7 feet high, and I still got books that need to be on a shelf. But at least I can turn around my chair from my computer operating position here and scan the books and go to a book that I need some bit of information on, because it's miserable when you know something but you can't find it and you can't remember necessarily which book it's in. I've got one that I want to share quite a bit with you after a while. Well, before we go back to the invasion of the South by Northern corporates, predatory capitalists, more to steal the wealth of the South than to help any Negroes. That's a laugh. But anyhow, this book, I mentioned it before, I think, and I want to encourage you all to get it because it's a fantastic book. I read it about a year or two ago. It's called Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II and the End of Civilization by Nicholson Baker. Now, he goes into all these rotten plots against the Japanese and rotten plots by the Japanese against the Chinese and rotten plots of the Germans against France or whatever. I mean, he's got it all in this book. It's a big, thick book. It's one of the best historical books, and it's all indexed, too. It's all great. We're going to get into it one of these days. I did want to get into that part about how we were already putting bomber squadrons in China, getting ready to attack Japan long before Pearl Harbor. Let me see. Yeah, that's over 550 pages. But I'll bet by now you could get it pretty cheap. I haven't tried. And it'd be a good book for inmates in the prison, POWs, because they can, if they tear the hard covers off, you can get it into the prison. And that book would keep a prisoner busy for a long time. And that's what we should be encouraging them to do. They've got all this time on their hands. They need to study and become experts on just about everything. You know, you can go to college in prison, in some prisons, I guess. And some of the guys do. And some of the order has done that. But it's something that needs to be encouraged instead of just sitting in your cell reading mad comic books. Okay, here we go. Let's find where we're at with my friends down south. Claude Bowers. Okay, where do I start here? Oh, there's my arrow. I made a mark in the book. Nussbaum was born and raised in Canada. See, this is this Jew that came down south and set up business. Interesting why a Jew from Canada would come to a backwater town in Mississippi to establish some kind of settlement. I think there's more to that than meets the eye, too. Nussbaum was born and raised in Canada, but settled in the United States in 1926. He studied for the rabbinate at the Hebrew College at Cincinnati, later receiving a degree from the University of Cincinnati, and did graduate work at the Universities of Colorado, Ottawa, and Melbourne, Australia. And I'm sure during that time he spread a lot of the Jewish bullshit. As it turned out that he was better with books than people. Ordained in 33, he embarked upon the nomadic life of a small-town rabbi, first accepting a post at a Reform congregation in Melbourne, and then before World War II serving as a prison chaplain in Pueblo, Colorado. Interesting. They won't let most of our material into the prisons, but they'll let these serpent-tongued Jews in, you know? So as he was working as a chaplain at Pueblo, Colorado, there he accompanied a teenage Jewish boy to the gas chamber at the prison in Cannon City. Writing about it later, he said, "I have never forgotten that awful experience of the gas chamber, and particularly the crowd of sheriffs, deputies, and lawmen who avidly peered through the glass watching him in the last throes, as well as hearing one of them say, 'Take that, you damn Jew.'" After serving as an army chaplain in the Philippines during World War II, he accepted an appointment with an associate rabbi in Trenton, New Jersey, a post several other prospective candidates had turned down. New Jersey was followed by stints in Texas, Kansas, Long Island, and Pittsfield, Massachusetts. These guys are like little bees spreading their bullshit from flower to flower. In June of 1954, Rabbi Nathan Perelman, chairman of the placement committee of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, suggested Nussbaum apply for the post in Jackson, where Mayor Leavitt had just retired. As Polner described it in Rabbi, the book, Perelman told Nussbaum, "It's a wonderful congregation. There, they'll all appreciate you. The South is known for its eretz, respect for its rabbinical leaders," until they met Claude Bowers and Tommy Terrence. "You can do as little or as much as you want to. Jackson is beautiful, wide streets, clean, a wonderful southern city. Perry, you'll like it, because they keep the niggers in their place down there. Take Irene and your daughter down there and drink mint juleps the rest of your life. Don't worry about the niggers, they'll be taken care of." Nussbaum flew to Jackson for an interview. Almost exactly a month before, on May 17, 1954, the Supreme Court had handed down its decision outlawing segregation in public schools. Well, that was the time for a revolution. If there ever has been a time for a revolution in our history, it was at that moment. It could have started, and it could have been successful in Little Rock, Arkansas. If you read the history of what Eisenhower and Nixon were talking about, you'll see it was possible. National Jewish organizations had hailed the ruling. Yeah. But the reaction among Temple Beth Israel congregation was less favorable, say the least. Well, you see, you know, the Jews, when they get in areas where they're living around large numbers of Negroes, they can see the handwriting on the wall, and they sort of go along with things. Landing in the Jackson Municipal Airport, Nussbaum was met by a small group of local Jews. The temperature was a staggering 133 degrees and humid. That southern humidity, it's a killer. They had hardly finished exchanging pleasantries when a member of the delegation got down to business. Quote, "What is your position about school desegregation?" Unquote. With uncharacteristic restraint, Nussbaum finessed the question. After 20 years of bouncing from one anonymous post to another, he was eager for the job, which he told friends offered a unique challenge in the wake of the Supreme Court's desegregation decision. So he didn't, he went right along with segregation. to make sure of his job. He did not exactly lie to the selection committee. He merely said he had never paid much attention to the issue. Bullshit. And that was the truth as far as it went. He told the committee he would have to follow his conscience, but would never do anything to cause problems for his congregation. Well, that would mean staying away and embracing segregation. That was at least half true, because he did intend to follow his conscience and he was not indifferent to the feelings of the congregation. In the beginning, Nussbaum kept his views on race relations pretty much to himself. His wife, Irene, a native of Texas, thought he did not understand the Southern race relations and was naive about what he could do and what he could not do about civil rights or civil wrongs. But when the Freedom Riders began pouring into Jackson and all across the South in 61, he could no longer finesse the issue with his conscience or with his congregation. The first Freedom Ride began in Washington, D.C. on May 4th, when 6 whites and 7 blacks set out on a Greyhound bus to challenge the segregation of travel facilities in Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. The initial demonstrators and the scores and hundreds who followed were met almost everywhere by police harassment and violence. Yeah, you weren't wanted. You were not wanted. You were an invader. And when you're an invader and you get hurt, don't blame the people. In Jackson, police routinely arrested the demonstrators and charged them with violating a section of the Code of Mississippi originally drafted in 1960. To prevent wade-ins by blacks trying to use Biloxi's whites-only public beaches. Incidentally, a friend of mine was in on the riots in Florida. What was the name of that town? I'll think of it later on. They had a massive race riot on the beach there in Florida. And my friend was the guy who instigated it. He's dead now, and I can't remember his name either. But I'll come up with it. He's the guy that used to carry machine guns around in his trunk. I never saw them, but other people did. He was a real fighter, and so was his brother. But like most people who really are true to the system, true to the story, true to the core, they die without anybody even hardly recognizing. You don't see any of these right-wing Southerners ever talking about them. The guys that really stood up for the South. Violating the provision was a misdemeanor with a maximum punishment of $200 fine and 4 months in jail. Eventually, the Jackson jail overflowed and the civil rights demonstrators began to be transferred to Parchman State Prison almost 150 miles away. Probably north. Once a week throughout the blistering hot summer of 61, Nussbaum drove to Parchman alone to visit the demonstrators. The car was not air-conditioned and the temperatures often soared into the high 90s. Good. The rabbi took personal items, soap and cigarettes and such, to the prisoners. I wonder if he ever did that to white people, unless they were involved in integration. He collected the names and addresses of relatives and other people close to them. After each visit, Nussbaum sent mimeographed letters of reassurance and other demonstrators, relatives, and friends. He included in the envelopes any personal notes he had been given as well. Well, he was guilty of aiding the enemy in time of war. Simple as that. It was the South was on a war footing. And anybody that would be helping the enemy to promote and push race mixing, you fall under that label of treason, no matter where you come from or whether you're a Jew or not. Even then, fearful of upsetting his congregation and perhaps antagonizing Jackson's political leadership, Nussbaum kept a relatively low profile. He never tried to conceal the visits, but he did not go out of his way to draw attention to them either. In other words, he was wishy-washy. Once he needed authorization from the Hinds County Sheriff to get inside Parchment, and the sheriff asked, "Why would you want to go visit those nutty people?" Nussbaum, not wanting to jeopardize his chance of receiving the authorization, replied, "I'm not making any judgments about whether what they do is right or wrong, but they need some kind of contact with the clergy." He was struggling to live up to his pledge to the selection committee. He knew that, given the increasingly fevered climate of Mississippi, being more open about his views on racial justice or injustice could threaten not only his own safety, but that of his family, but the safety of his entire congregation. Well, you're behind enemy lines and you're the enemy. What do they do in any country when you're behind the lines? Yet he had an increasingly difficult time squaring that concern with his conscience and with what he saw in his failure to take more overt action on such a momentous moral issue. Of course, this is a lot like it is in the Middle East. The war machine in this country sends young men over there to fight, kill, bomb, waterboard, and everything else, people in their own country. And then they say, when they rebel and slit their throat, "Oh, we're trying to bring them democracy. Why would they do that? Why would they act this way? I can't understand it. We Americans are such peace-loving people." Like everyone in the state, Nussbaum knew the penalties for failing to embrace segregation wholeheartedly. That's right. Should be. For her defiance of racists, Hazel Brannon Smith, publisher of the Lexington Advisor North, Advertiser north of Jackson, lost her advertising, her county printing contract, and all her friends in town. Well, her insurance was canceled. Her husband lost his job as a hospital administrator, and a cross was burned on their lawn. Somehow, Smith managed to keep publishing, but most business people were not so resilient. In Macomb, after the insurance executive Albert Red Hefner Jr. wrote a letter asking the governor to make a statement supporting law and order following the burning of four black churches, segregationists harassed him with obscene telephone calls, threatened to bomb his house, then terminated his office lease, and spread rumors that he had a communist connection. His insurance business withered and his old friends shunned him. The Hefners packed up and moved. So there were people doing their little bit, trying to hold up the old system. Even voicing support for the public schools was dangerous after the legislature gave local officials the authority to close them to avoid desegregation. Every Friday morning, a group of women met secretly in different homes to discuss ways to keep the schools open. One of them, Gloria Minor, wife of Bill Minor, Jackson correspondent of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Yeah, there is a system paper if you ever want to see it. Some of the worst articles about white separatists have been printed in that paper. They sure love David Duke, I'll tell you that. Bridled upon hearing Harry Reasoner in a CBS documentary ask why moderates were not speaking out in Mississippi, I jumped up and said, "You come down here and find out what's happening to people when they do speak out." And I thought to myself, this is the way it must have been in Germany in the 30s. Leave it to the Jew. He's always going to hearken back to Germany. Despite the climate of fear, an occasional ludicrous incident relieving the tension, Winifred Green, a young Jackson housewife, was one of the founders, along with Patricia Darien, Elaine Crystal, and Joan Geiger, of Mississippians for Public Education, the statewide organization that evolved from those emotionally charged Friday morning coffee clutches, traveling around encouraging people to organize on behalf of public schools. Green wound up receiving a wave of hate telephone calls. The Jackson White Citizens Council, in a recorded message program called Dial the Truth, said, "If you want to know why your child will be forced to go to school with niggers, call Mrs. Samuel Falls," Green's married name at the time, "and gave her telephone number. Her husband fielded the calls, and one Sunday morning, fed up with a stream of hate, he grabbed the telephone and, without waiting for the caller to speak, shouted, "You son of a bitch, stop bothering us and don't ever call here again." Falls was fair-skinned, and his wife watched as the back of his neck turned deep red. Finally, she heard him say, "Yes, Mother, we'd be happy to come over for lunch after church." The main instrument for preserving the white supremacy, in addition to the Ku Klux Klan, were the private white citizens' consuls, and the state supported Mississippi's Sovereignty Commission. Well, those two were limp wristed at best. They were the businessman's answer to white supremacy. We don't want to lose any money. We feel this way, but we don't want to lose any money over it. The consuls were so effective that after the school desegregation decision, the Klan did not become a major factor in Mississippi until Sam Bowers organized the White Knights in 64. In their recruiting literature in 1960, the consuls took credit for the fact that in Mississippi, unlike other states, blacks had not even attempted sit-ins. Well, I think they gave the consuls far more credit than they deserve. They're still around, but they're wishy-washy. And they'll never say nigger anymore. The consuls were a direct response to the Supreme Court's 1954 school desegregation decision, better known as white enslavement. Shortly after it was issued, a group of bankers, lawyers, planters, and businessmen met secretly in the Delta town of Indianola to discuss the impending danger. The minutes of the Citizens Council meeting, reprinted in an Anti-Defamation League bulletin, I wonder how they got that, contained the crux of the approach the consuls followed. Quote, "It is the thought of our group that the solution of this problem of desegregation may become easier if various agitators and the like could be removed from the communities in which they now operate. We propose to accomplish this through the careful application of economic pressures." Well, economic pressures never do the whole job. There's no way just using economic pressures will solve that problem. Their goal was to drive out, but that's the way capitalists think. And that's the way these money boys think. Oh, we can solve this problem using money pressure. Sometimes it takes a lot more than money pressure. Their goal was to drive out dissenters, black and white, by destroying their livelihoods. Gee, that's what they do to us today. Within a year, there were approximately 300 consuls and 65,000 dues-paying members. There you go. Money got involved. Thousands of chapters sprang up in 9 other southern states, but none acted with them more ruthless efficiency than Mississippi's professors, who did not support segregation were blacklisted. Companies that flouted the rules were boycotted, and the names of people who signed petitions promoting desegregation were publicized. In such a climate, everyone was fearful, no one more so than Mississippi's comfortable but vulnerable Jewish population, which in 1955 numbered about 3,250. Roughly 1.5% of the state's total population. Small wonder that Rabbi Nussman tried to hide his true feelings as long as he could. As word began to spread about his civil rights activities, Nussbaum became increasingly nervous. Writing during the early 60s in the Journal of the Central Conference on American Rabbis, a Cincinnati-based publication unlikely to be read in Mississippi, he declared, quote, "Sometimes you're sure your phone was tapped. You wondered about some of the mail, delivered and undelivered. Talk about the clergy and mental health. Some of us were chapter and verse in the textbook of paranoia. When we were reasonably sure of one another, we dared voice what was treason to the South, behind closed doors and admittedly foolhardy and impractical from the pulpit." See, here's the Jews admitting treason to the South. The other emotion he struggled with was guilt. In 1961, when Nussbaum received reports that a group of freedom riders coming to Jackson had included several rabbis, he agonized over how to keep them out. He admired their willingness to protest, but felt their presence in Mississippi would expose the Jewish community to controversy and possible danger. One night, he sought out William Kunstler and Carl Recklin. Of course, William Kunstler was an open communist I think I debated him once on television way back. He's been dead a long time, but he was a hardcore Red. Two young New York lawyers who represented some of the demonstrators. Kunstler was just beginning to make a national reputation as a civil wrongs attorney. He later cited Jackson as the searing experience that radicalized him. And Richland was general counsel for the Congress of Racial Equality. And the Congress of Racial Equality was the one who... The leader of that outfit was the one in later years that tried to choke John, my son, to death on national TV. Nussbaum thought that they could help him stop the rabbis. Kunstler and Rushland had been in a trial in Hinds County Courthouse that had not adjourned until almost 11 p.m., and it was close to midnight when they returned to the Sun and Sand Motel. Dead tired, they were surprised to be approached in the lobby by a man wearing a dark business suit and worried expression. Nussbaum introduced himself and apologized for the late hour, but said he had an extremely important matter to discuss. They went to Kunstler's room. Nussbaum sat at the edge of the bed. Rushland and Kunstler sat down in upholstered chairs. The rabbi said Jackson was becoming a racial powder keg that might explode. Quote, "I'm a Jew, and you're Jews," Nussbaum began, "and you ought to help keep the rabbis from coming in here because they're going to cause severe problems for the Jewish community," unquote. The lawyers were stunned. Kunstler thought Nussbaum looked terrified and could not understand why. As someone with no experience in the South, Kunstler had not the slightest idea of the conflicting pressures and fears of reprisal and violence that weighed on Nussbaum. The Jewish tradition of the social consciousness, the sense of obligation as a leader of an oppressed minority, yada, 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 the keen awareness of his congregation's vulnerabilities, the hard-earned knowledge that in Mississippi it was known often necessary to put realism before idealism. Kunstler did not know that for months, quietly and largely behind the scenes, Nussbaum had defied his congregation by ministering to imprisoned freedom riders.
Well, I'm not in Mississippi, but this humidity here in the Midwest is getting really high today, so I feel right at home reading this book. Nussbaum tried to explain that the white citizens' councils were imposing devastating economic sanctions on anyone else who even suspected of holding racially moderate views. Moderate means they only want to mix half of the whites, I guess. Jews, too, were under pressure to conform, either to join the consuls, in some cases in which whole Delta towns went citizens' consul. The few Jewish residents joined, too, some out of fear and some because they were hard rock segregationists. Gee whiz, racist Jews? I sympathize with what they're doing and think it's just a cause, Nussbaum told Kunstler, but you have to an obligation to your fellow Jews, too. Kunstler believed a rabbi should be out in front of on the issue of racial justice. Easy for him to say, he's from the North, he'd go back home. Jews had a proud history of working for civil wrongs. Rabbi Stephen Wise was one of the incorporators of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in New York City in 1909, and two Jews had served as the presidents of the NAACP organization. I remember Kivi Kaplan, and I forget who the others were. Kunstler felt that after centuries of enduring discrimination, for no reason, were such innocent people, Jews should be first to protest when others were victimized. Well, why don't they get involved when I was victimized? And rabbis should put into practice the principles of justice woven into their sermons. Yeah, they're very interested in getting involved as long as it's something they believe in. Anybody they don't believe in, piss on them. It's crazy to think we'll urge rabbis not to participate in the freedom rides, Kunstler told Nussbaum. We have an obligation to do something about the injustice down here.
Well, Counselor, are you going to put your ass out there on the firing line? Talk about outside agitators. Don't you know that Dr. King, forget that doctor shit, he never did deserve that doctor crap. We've got a lot of that in the right wing, too. People running around calling themselves Dr. Warner and other people in the right wing. They're no more doctor than my dog. Has asked all sorts of clergymen to come here, and his own executive assistant, Reverend Wyatt T. Walker, is here. Now, I'll bet you anything he's not white. That's different, Nussbaum replied. Christian congregations don't have the same vulnerability that Jewish congregations have. It's particularly different here in the Deep South, where we're a small minority. If the rabbis come in here, it'll just draw attention to the Jews and could cause a pogrom. Kunstler found Nussbaum's comments depressing. Someone had told him that the local rabbi was a liberal, but here Nussbaum was pleading for him to keep other rabbis from coming into Jackson. Yet Kunstler was intrigued by the entreaty, too, and he listened to Nussbaum intently. They debated the issue until almost 3 o'clock in the morning. The rabbi left confident he had done his best to argue his case, but disappointed Red Kunstler was unswayed, because his job as a communist agitator, he knew what his job was. During this period, the ceaseless pull and tug of conflicting obligations tried Nussbaum's spirit. On October 6, 1964, he wrote to Rabbi Samuel S. Suskin of Brooklyn, New York, quote, I had never shut my door or rebuffed my colleagues, but some things are hard to take, like the young man who was here for a total of 48 hours told me how thrilled he was over his insights and how thrilled he was for me that I am helping to make history. I told him to make history in his own backlashed community. On another occasion, he complained to Ken Dean, the young Baptist minister he helped select to head the Mississippi Council on Human Relations, to be criticized from all sides. My people in the Jewish community think I expose them to vulnerabilities that they don't need, and they're already a minority group, he told Dean. They say I'm bringing on potential for violence and the criticism they're already discriminated against because of being Jewish. On the other hand, the Negroes criticize me for being white and not doing enough. Even when I offer a prayer at a civil rights meeting, I catch it from all sides. Christians don't like it because I pray as a Jew. Nussbaum told Dean that as poor as Jackson Jews' record was on civil rights, civil wrongs, was, it was better than the records of any Christian group you can point to. Rabbi Nussbaum, you can't name but 4 people in your congregation that really support civil wrongs for Negroes, Dean said. Well, you're right, Nussbaum replied, and that's 4 out of 140 families, and that's twice what any other religious group in Jackson can point to. Nussbaum did have a handful of soulmates in the congregation, Emmanuel and Elaine Crystal. Oh, Billy Crystal's parents supported the civil rights movement and defended Nussbaum. They also provided food for many of the freedom riders and served as contacts for parents in the North concerning about sons and daughters who traveled to Jackson to demonstrate. So they were spies behind the lines. Manny Crystal was chairman of the board of the Crawler Parts Incorporated, a large firm that imported parts for heavy equipment from Italy. He was relatively immune to the economic pressure that forced many to conform. Elaine Crystal was even more active and outspoken on racial matters than her husband, having been a founder of the Mississippians for Public Education, in other words, race-mixed education. Privately, some of the other Jews supported the civil wrongs cause, but they were afraid to be identified, more out of fear of economic retaliation than out of any concern about physical danger. Isn't that typically Jewish? They worry more about the money than physically threatened. But the overwhelming majority of Jews in Jackson and elsewhere in Mississippi held views that were indistinguishable from those of their neighbors. for them an unwelcome complication was that so many of the demonstrators were Northern Jews. Roughly 50% of all the demonstrators and about 70% of the lawyers who represented them were Jewish. It made it much harder for Southern Jews to remain inconspicuous, you see. We always used to say that it was made up of 50% of all the demonstrators and about 70% of the lawyers who represented them were Jewish. Now, here is the Jews, what are they, 2%, 3% in the country? But 50%. So when the South and the Klan used to yell about the Jews were running the civil rights fraud, they were true. They were right. But they were called names, and no, up north they were called names, and that's not true. Yes, there's some Jews, but not many. 50% is many. The way Joe Harris looked at it, the outside agitators should have stayed home. Here we have all these people coming down here that are obviously Jewish. Schwerner, Goodman, and Goldbergs, and the Levines, and the Cohens, and all these obvious Jewish names. We're all sitting here trying to make a living and trying to get along and trying to live in a super predominant, very, very Christian society. And all of a sudden, here they are. And the way it's looking down here is that all Jews think alike. Harris was one of the Jewish community's most outspoken defenders of the Southern ways of life. Once during a visit to St. Louis, he encountered a young civil rights activist who was excited to learn that he was from Jackson. "I was down in Jackson," the young man said proudly. "I was a freedom rider down there," unquote. "Yeah," Harris replied acidly. "How do you like our jails?" Against such sentiment, Nussbaum was hard-pressed to hang on to his job. He needed all the support he could get from the defenders such as Crystals and Sidney Geiger, the president of Delta Steel Corporation. "Enter the ruling class," a Jackson-based metal fabrication concern. Several times they helped squelch proposals to fire the rabbi that came within inches of succeeding. Nussbaum, in an article in the Cincinnati Rabbinical Journal, portrayed himself as perhaps the last remaining liberal clergyman in Jackson and described his feelings in Old Testament terms. "So this last survivor is running scared. Tell me, colleagues, how did Isaac feel when the knife was poised over his head?" Unquote. Now, these are things you need to know, and this is one of the most honest portrayals of what was going on in the South during that period of time, and it's pretty straight. And you can see now there's a lot of Jews who integrate, and they didn't want any part of race mixing or the Northern crap, desegregation. But, of course, there's always the radicals of the Jews who always want to, they've always got a cause. They've always got a cause to fight, whether it's communism, Marxism, whatever it is, gay rights, same-sex marriage. The Jews will always gravitate to that kind of stuff, or a percentage of the Jews. Of course, not all the Jews. The summer of 64 marked a turning point for Nussbaum. Stepping out of the shadows, he took a leading role in organizing the Committee of Concern, a biracial, interdenominational group founded to raise money for rebuilding black churches torched by the Klan. Blacks don't realize it, but the best thing that could happen to them is those black churches be torched. Either that or convert them into something, regular schools or something like that, that could really benefit the black race. But the problem is they kept following Christianity and they weren't getting anywhere. They weren't getting more education, that's for sure. So, he was one of the six clergymen who founded the committee, which subsequently grew to include scores of ministers throughout the state. Nussbaum, the only rabbi in its 30-member executive committee, was a leader in helping raise about $750,000 to rebuild 44 churches. Now, if they'd replaced those with schools, teaching science, business, everything else, instead of rebuilding Christian churches, which are nothing but synagogues, they'd really done some good for the black race. With everything else that was happening that summer, Nussbaum's effort to be on behalf of the committee might have passed unnoticed. Hundreds of white volunteers were flooding into Jackson. You see, there you go. Our worst enemy is among us. Always has been. Maybe always will be. Meridian, Hattiesburg, and several other cities as part of Mississippi Freedom Summer. The state, from the highest public officials on down, considered itself under siege. The White Knights formed only the previous February, but already a force to be reckoned with. We're engaged in a rampage of violence and destruction. Yeah, but still, I'm saying they went after the wrong people. They didn't go after key people. Key people, the traitors in the white race, and the key traitors in the ruling class. You got to remember that. You're going out there and grabbing those niggers and hanging from a tree doesn't really change anything. It, in fact, it makes the job worse. But if crooked, rotten, corrupt political leaders and business leaders started getting whacked, there you got something. Then they have to bring the troops in. And then people would respond to the troops as an invasion and guerrilla warfare would begin. That's a little basic and to the point, but and the combination of Nussbaum's efforts to help the black churches and the freedom fighters, writers, was enough to set Sam Bowers off. He ranted against the communist Jewish conspiracy at Klan meetings. Well, Sam, going to UCLA, must have known about the ruling class connections to this thing, too. I guess at the time, I know, yelling communist, communist, communist was very popular because I was in that mood, too. But that's not the heart of the problem. Follow the money. Follow the money. In the end, a Klan informant reported to the FBI. Bowers concluded that Mississippi's Jews faced too many problems of their own to spend much time participating in civil wrongs activities and decided not to target them at the time. The informant might have added that Bowers' plate was too full just then to deal with the Nussbaum. While the rabbi was raising money to restore burned-out black churches, which is a waste of time. Well, not really, because Christianity keeps the niggers in line. Ever since the plantation, ever since they were freed, and even before that, they got them all involved in Christianity, and they've been enslaved ever since. But the whites have been enslaved too, and they don't have any excuse. Bowers and his fellow white knights were busy planning and carrying out kidnapping and killing of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. Bowers did not forget about Nussbaum, however. In March 1967, Beth Israel congregation had arrived at a momentous point in its 106-year history. A long-planned new temple had at last been completed, and ambitious arrangements had been made for the dedication. Now, that I think that was a mistake of the Jews to do that at that time. That was like giving a finger to the white knights. I think they should have waited a few years to build that temple. The first temple Beth Israel built in 1861 had been burned by federal troops during the Civil War. Burned by the federal troops, not the Confederates. I don't think it was an accident either. A replacement temple erected in 1867 also fell victim to the fire. The third temple, a beautiful Gothic building, that's interesting, according to a news account of the day, was built in 1875 with solid walnut pews and elegantly carved altar, reflecting the times. It was architecturally indistinguishable from Jackson's Lutheran, Methodist, Episcopalian, and other Christian churches. A fourth temple also carried on this assimilationist tradition. Nussbaum changed that with a vengeance. The new temple was unmistakably Jewish. That was another thing he was causing himself trouble. It sounds good on paper, but sort of like the Nazi Party going to march through Skokie, Illinois. If the Republican Party had marched through Skokie, it would have been different, but Nazis, as he could, Jewish as he could make it, with its sprawling roof suggesting the tents occupied by children of Israel during their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness after Exodus and all their fucking lies in the Old Testament. At the same time, of course, there's nobody hooked any worse than the Jews themselves believing this shit. At the same time, when it came to the dedication, the rabbi went to great lengths to make it ecumenical. The site of the new temple on Old Canton Road was closed to two Protestant churches, Christ Methodist immediately to the east and St. Philip's Episcopal just across the road. Nussbaum called the area Holy Corners. I call them Holy Mind Control Centers. The neighboring ministers, as well as other Christian church leaders, were invited to the ceremonies. Oh, yeah. Nussbaum also insisted that the ceremonies be interracial. Oh, yeah, come on, niggers. Bring your best white girl. White ministers, including Catholic bishop and an Episcopal bishop, were joined by two black Protestant ministers in the procession carrying the Torah into the temple. Three of the five members of the building committee refused to participate in the ceremonies. Now you can see how Bowers, White Knights of Mississippi, their attention first was turned away because they didn't see the Jews as a big deal. But here's this northern Jew, Canadian Jew actually, coming into town, going to build a big temple, not looking like just regular churches, but like Middle Eastern temples and so forth. And then he's going to bring all the race mixing right into the church, into his temple. So you think that might have gotten Terrence's attention? I think so. Well, anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. And in the meantime, let it sink in and think about all this. Because remember, white people were really under the gun during all this. And with all the federal FBI was all over the place. Federal troops came in. The people were pushed to the wall. Unfortunately, they didn't stand up to the invasion and shoot it out with them. If there had been hundreds of people laying dead in the streets down there over this desegregation, I think Washington would turn around and change its mind a little bit, especially since they're mostly hypocrites anyhow in their daily activities. Are racist as hell, most of these congressmen and senators, these white ones. If you read their private papers, they're phony racist. They're racist, but they'll lie and cheat and do anything to maintain power. See you tomorrow. Oh yeah, but these guys, they'll never combine with the white working class, because they despise the white working class more than the blacks.